need to restart the recorder.
You may be seated. Thank you, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are pleased to convene today in the Brown County Courthouse here in New Ulm. The next matter on our case for oral argument is the matter of the welfare of the child of NAL and DES. I think you're both familiar with our procedures. You will each have 15 minutes to make your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, should you choose to use it. It is important that you be mindful of your time, which is indicated there. I can't see it, but I have it on good authority that makes a very loud noise when your time has expired. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent because we are recording these arguments. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mayor. May it please the court. What are the limits of a trial court's discretion when an agency licensed by the state places a child for adoption? That adoption placement is then ratified in court. Then the state, through a separate agency, decides to place the child with a grandmother 5 months later. A motion for adoptive placement follows. The county's own written request, another 5 months later, then supports placement with the adoptive parents, only to lose the child after 16 months to a new relative who never filed for adoption and never requested notice. That is the question here before the court.
I acknowledge that the procedural history and procedural posture of this case is unusual and challenging, but the bottom line, is there anything that either the agency or the county did that technically violated any of the relevant statutes?
The relevant statutes. Well, I would argue that there's no actual statute that says this is what you have to do in this particular instance, right? There's a lot of discretion here. I recognize that. But discretion does not occur in a vacuum either. And I would say that there are many statutes that provide the framework for how that discretion needs to be applied. So, yes, we have multiple statutes that address timelines in a permanency proceeding, all of which were blown in this case. We have case law that focuses on the importance of permanency on a schedule that doesn't unduly delay a child's permanent placement. I think it's well recognized under the law that timelines for a child are different than timelines for adults, if that answers the court's question.
Well, in this case does. I mean, there was a lot going on simultaneously because you had the private placement adoption that was in the works at the time of the child's birth, and then the county immediately starting TPR proceedings, and while there may have been delays of months at a time, as I understand the record, the county did do a relative search, and maybe not as quickly as they should have, but
they did do a relative search, not within the 30 days required by statute. They did do a relative search about 2 months after the child was born. They did not at that time identify the relative that then was brought into this case 10 months later.
Right, but the relative they identified was somebody that they thought at the time would be able to, and the relative that had been identified later, my understanding of the record, either didn't express interest at that time, correct?
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that the relative had an affirmative duty to come to the county and say that they wanted notice and that they wanted to be considered for placement of this child, and they did not do that.
So you think the line should be on the relative, the potential placement, relative, versus the county to find the relatives?
Yes, Your Honor. Under 260C.221, I do believe that relatives have an affirmative duty to request notice and information regarding a child if they're interested in placement. This then allows them to request consideration under 260C.607, subdivision 5B, Much as with the paternity requirements, there is an affirmative duty to come forward and say, I'm interested in this child. And if that doesn't happen, where does that leave us? So in this case, 10 months in, when the child has formed an attachment, when the county itself has said enough time has passed. I mean, the county's letter, I urge the court to look at that, specifically says, this has been too long for the kiddo.
And in which letter is that?
That's the May 24th.
The May 2018 letter?
Yes. The county explicitly says that in their letter. So now we're looking at a new relative at 10 months who's made no efforts of their own prior to that point, and that the county knew about this entire process, never investigated, never looked at, has no home study. They do not have any idea if this could be a placement or not for this child 10 months into the case.
Right, but my point is that the county was initially looking at one relative that, for a variety of reasons, didn't work out, and then they started looking for another relative.
Well, under the statute,
they looked at an alternative relative.
They looked at alternatives at the beginning as well.
I guess my point is, and I think Judge Brockman might have been alluding to this too. I mean, this is a unique situation, a unique case in a variety of ways, and I'm not so sure that there's anybody to blame per se. My question is whether or not the district court actually abuses discretion.
I think the district
decision.
Yes, I think that the district court absolutely abused its discretion in that decision. One, because it would significantly delay permanency, which under statute...
Which decision are we talking...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, what decision, before you move into how the decision reflects abuse of discretion, what specific decision are you talking about?
I guess I was responding to Judge Reyes's question. I thought he was... Well, I guess I will ask you to clarify the question as to which decision you're asking me about, or I can...
I'm going to answer your question with a question.
Okay.
Which decision by the district court are you challenging?
I am challenging two decisions. The first decision is the decision to deny the county's motion to relieve it of relative efforts. The hearing was on May 30th, 2018. And then the following decision of the appeal, the final order that we are appealing in this matter, the November 19, 2018 order, which I would argue, because it was built on the scaffolding of what was in itself an abuse of discretion, cannot be a proper order. So we are challenging both the interim order, allowing the relative search to continue, and then the final order that is then based off of that allowance for the search to continue.
Meaning the order denying your client's petition to adopt.
Correct, the November 19th order. And I would point the court to the case law of, in the matter of the welfare of JLG, where the court stated that by basing the trial court's decision that grandmother had failed to establish a prima facie showing for a most fit adoptive placement on the erroneous legal conclusion that grandmother had been previously ruled out as a placement option, the district court abuses discretion. And I would say likewise here, district court basing its denial of my client's motion for adoptive placement on the erroneous decision to allow relative search to continue, the district court abused its discretion in its final order.
All right, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying, that if the county had been relieved of its relative search obligation in May of 18, you presume that the district court would have granted your client's or granted the motion for the private adoption?
Correct, Your Honor, because the county's motion in its May 24th letter was stating that the time had come to relieve of relative efforts because they recognized that now we're at this tipping point where it was no longer in the best interest of the child to be removed from the home where he had been attached. The guardian ad litem supported that.
Wasn't there a very quick turnaround? I thought that even by the time of the hearing on that motion, there had been new information and the county had backed off and said, no, we've just learned of another relative. Am I wrong about that?
It was not new information, Your Honor. It was a change in the county's position between the letter and then when the motion was actually held.
Right, I mean, that was a short period of time, correct?
It was, but I don't think that that changes the fact that the county still made a determination that it was not in the best interest of the child to move them 10 months into a case.
And I have concerns about the impact of the child as well. I think, as you stated so eloquently, I mean, the period of time that may seem short to us is a lifetime to a young child. But I want to direct you to the statute that governs the motion for the private adoption. And under, as I understand it, the district court agreed that your clients made a prima facie showing that the child should be placed with them for adoption, and that's why there was this evidentiary hearing. Correct.
Correct. Are we looking at 260C.607?
Correct.
Just so we're all clear.
Yeah, I mean, that's the statutory correct. Basis for your
for
client's request,
motion.
Correct?
Correct.
So we really, when we're reviewing the district court's final order, we review it based on whether it complies with this particular statute, correct?
Yes.
All right, and as I understand it, there was this, that the moving party, meaning your clients, has the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence that the agency has been unreasonable in failing to make the adoptive placement. Correct?
Yes.
And the district court here found that your clients hadn't met that burden. What's the strongest evidence that, in fact, the county was unreasonable in denying your request of placement?
I think that's a two-part answer. I would argue that going back to the scaffolding issue,
switch of change of position within that May two-week period or week.
Correct. So I think honestly that the county's own letter and the guardian ad litem's position saying enough is enough for this child itself meets that preponderance of the evidence standard, and that it's unreasonable.
But now you're arguing that that shows unreasonableness of the county. They withdrew that motion, right?
I'm saying that that showed unreasonableness in our initial motion. So our motion was that they were unreasonable in not placing with us. My contention is that the county itself conceded, you're right, we were unreasonable. We should place with your client. And at that point in time, that should have been that meets the preponderance of evidence standard. And again, we were in the middle of an evidentiary hearing at this point. That had already started. And then when you get to the final piece of the evidentiary hearing with the new relative appearing, I think the strongest evidence we have is the undisputed testimony of the only attachment expert that was presented in this case. There were not competing experts. There was not competing testimony on the level of attachment between this child and my clients. That testimony was uncontroverted. And it firmly established the importance of that attachment and that primary parental relationship for the child and how that leads through all of the best interest factors.
To what extent do the best interest factors inform a district court's decision on whether an agency has been unreasonable in making an adoptive placement?
Well, that is the scaffolding that the district court needs to look at to make that determination. Because in order to make a placement of a child, we need to look at the individualized assessment, or the assessment of the individualized needs of that child.
Apparently the paint fumes made something go off, and then I guess it's the category of no good deed goes unpunished. But welcome back to the court. We are going to give you, Ms. Osband, 3 minutes back so we can kind of get back into your argument.
Okay, thank you, Dad.
Proceed that way.
So I believe Your Honor had just asked me about the rule of 260C 0.212's best interest factors in making the determination.
To what extent that they impact the determination whether a county unreasonably failed to place the children with the child with your clients?
So they are the factors that the court needs to use under the statute. So 260C.607, subdivision 6, section E, states that at the conclusion of the evidentiary hearing, if the court finds that the agency has been unreasonable in failing to make the adoptive placement, and that the relative or the child's foster parent is the most suitable adoptive home to meet the child's needs using the factors in section 260C.212, subdivision 2.
But in this case, as I understand the district court's order, the district court indeed found that your clients hadn't met that burden of proof, and so that the county's failure to place the child for adoption with them was not unreasonable. So how do we get to a best interest finding in that case?
So I believe that the court's determination on the best interest factors was an abuse of discretion, given the evidence on the record.
Right, but do we even need to get to the best interest factors if the district found that the county did not act unreasonably? Isn't it really a two-step process? First, if the district finds the county acted unreasonably, then it gets into the best interest factors analysis, correct?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that in practice, the way it works is that you have to use those best interest factors to determine the reasonableness of the county's decision, because that is how a county is ordered to make its decision by statute.
Okay, so
it's by making an individualized determination.
That they're actually part and parcel to.
Correct. Correct.
And is there some case law that suggests that, or that's just how you view it as a correct comment?
It is, but also 260C.212 itself, subdivision 2.
You can complete your answer.
Placement decisions based on the best interest of the child sets out that the county must make its determination by requiring an individualized determination of the needs of the child and how the selective placement will serve the needs of the child being placed, and then it lists out the best interest factors.
But those are the factors to be used by the county, correct?
Correct. So when you're looking at the reasonableness of the decision by the county, that is how a county has to make its decision. So whether or not the decision is reasonable must go back to their decision under those best interest factors, because that's how they're statutorily mandated to decide what placement is best for a child. Whether it's between relatives, whether it's between relatives and a foster placement, each placement is supposed to have an assessment of those best interest factors.
It seems, though, that the district court is reviewing something more than like a de novo review of best interests based on the way 260C.607 reads.
Well, I believe, if I understand.
That was probably the clearest question. In 260C.607, mm-hmm. The language we were looking at earlier, at the conclusion of the evidentiary hearing, if the court finds that the agency has been unreasonable, then it should do some things. It seems inherent in that if the district court does not find that the county has been unreasonable, then it doesn't do that exercise.
So if the court finds that the county was reasonable in its placement, is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Then it doesn't necessarily need to move forward with making that determination. But I would argue that there's no other way to determine the reasonableness of the county's placement, because a county is mandated by statute to make placement in accordance with those best interest factors, along with the provision that it must consider relatives and significant persons. So those are the two parts that the county must consider when making its placements. And that does go beyond just the best interest factors. You look at, you know, the consideration requirement, you look at the best interest factors requirement, and then there's obviously the sibling aspect as well, which in this case I would argue is a little bit of a, in this case we have two siblings who never had been placed together, never lived together, and there are already siblings that had been placed in separate homes.
But nevertheless, they are siblings, and that's what the statute looks at.
The statute looks at whether they're siblings, but it also looks at whether placement would substantially delay a adoption and permanency, which in this case it did. So as a matter of law, that's not in the best interest of the child. And it also looks at if placement with a sibling is in the best interest, which again goes back to those questions of attachment and the factors. So it's not a, you know, black and white rule throughout statute.
I think you will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. I know it's all a little bit discombobulated with having the alarm go off, but.
And I do ask that the court reverse the lower court's finding.
Counsel for respondent. I think I'll have you just hold up 1 minute while we say goodbye to some of our visitors. We will see you later. I also see counsel for respondents TS and SB has arrived, and you are not presenting oral argument. You're relying on your brief. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
Okay. All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Adam Hins. I'm an assistant Martin County attorney, and I represent the respondent Human Services of Federal Martin County in this matter. There is nothing clearly erroneous in the district court's order denying appellant's motion for adoptive placement, and therefore this court must affirm. To grant a motion for adoptive placement, a district court must find both that the county was unreasonable and that the requested placement is the most suitable placement for the child. The burden of proving those findings is on the movement. If a court finds that the county was not unreasonable, the motion cannot be granted.
To what extent are the best interest factors relevant to that decision? The decision whether the county's failure to place with the proposed adoptive parents is unreasonable?
Well, the best interest statute 212 subdivision 2B requires the county to use the best interest factors in making placement decisions. So it would factor in so far as the county used those factors in its decision, and not necessarily whether the district court would come to the same conclusion on the factors, but whether the county was reasonable in that. So after hearing from the county that a basis decision not to make the adoptive placement on the statutory preferences of best interest factors, the court determined the county did not act unreasonably in this matter. There was no clear error in that finding, and appellants know that. Despite their burden, appellants entered no evidence in the district court that the county had acted in an arbitrary or capricious manner.
What do we make of the county's May 2018, albeit short-lived, motion to be relieved of reasonable efforts?
My reading of that letter was not a motion. It was a request for the court to decide the issue. I think the letter intentionally uses language such as may have reached a tipping point, and it creates possibilities. It does not request to be relieved of efforts, and it does not state we've reached the point. It recognizes that the guardian had lied and had come to that conclusion. And based on that and what had happened with the prior placement option, that the court should probably decide this issue. And when the county arrived in court, it had come to the decision that it was going to place a DS, or wanted to at least look at DS for placement, and wanted more time, so it did not want to be relieved.
So the court never ruled on, there was no motion to rule on, is that accurate?
I think once it got to the hearing, it had become clear that appellants and the guardian were requesting that the county be relieved, so the court construed that as a motion and ruled on that. I think looking at the court's findings and memo from that order, shows that the letter was intentionally vague. I think the court notes that at the very least it's unclear what the county's position was in that letter. Appellants are the only ones in this matter that have stated that it was a clear request by the county and a clear statement that may have reached a tipping point. But even if the court did err in that order, it doesn't really affect the outcome. In Chapter 260C, there are two statutes that govern the county's contact with relatives. Even if relieved of efforts, the court has to order that the county continue to engage relatives that responded to notice and to appropriately engage relatives who subsequently come to the county's attention. And that's 260C 193 subdivision 3D. And 260C 221A, which is the relative search statute, directly requires the county to continue to appropriately engage relatives.
What took so long? I mean, I don't understand why the, given that it's a close family relationship, an aunt, that it would have taken so long to identify the now current placement.
Honestly, I believe what took so long was errors by the county and the court and miscommunications. I think in communications between the mother and the county that's reflected in the case notes, it became clear that the mother came down to Fairmont out of the cities in an attempt to avoid everybody knowing so she could attempt to keep the child. And then the initial phone calls between the investigator and the grandmother, I don't think contained the appropriate statutory language or included all the statutory notices that were required to the grandmother. And those initial letters were never sent out. When the case manager got this, she did send permanency letters out because she had seen those and sent out. And the grandmother and one of the aunts finally responded to those, indicating that they were supporting placement.
Of what? Go ahead.
If the county made all these errors, how did the district court not abuse its discretion by not finding that the county acted unreasonably?
Because the errors...
I realize there are a lot of negatives in that, but...
Right. The errors the county made early on were errors against the relatives. The county has certain requirements for finding, notifying, and involving relatives, and they didn't do that appropriately.
I understand that, but they ultimately affected and delayed the time for a decision to be made for placement for the child.
Right.
Which is paramount consideration.
So the question before the district court was whether the county was unreasonable in failing to make a placement with appellants who are non-biological relatives. And by that point, biological relatives had gotten involved. The county introduced evidence that it did do best interest analyses with both the initial request, LM, and with BS and SB when they came forward. And the county testified that those analyses were done, as well as with appellants, and that the county came to the conclusion that despite attachment existing, because everybody agreed that attachment exists, that there were mitigating factors to possible harm from the attachment, and that the relatives could better meet the needs of the child, and so the best interest still favored a relative placement.
It seemed like it was a pretty close case, and even with the county, much less with the district court, in terms of the best interest factors, but it seemed to place a fair amount of value on the cultural background of the child being with the parent, with the family members. But there's also that in adoptive parents that took them. And what my concern is, you have the guardian ad litem who is looking out for the best interest of the child. That's the sole focus of the guardian ad litem. And oftentimes district courts give great weight to their testimony. And the guardian ad litem here said, no, enough is enough. We need to have these children, we need to have permanency for this child. Right. Why is it the county's decision not unreasonable given that, given the unrebutted testimony of the expert saying, you know what, this child has been with these, the adoptive parents, presumptive adoptive parents, for an extensive period of time. The change is going to be dramatic. Why wasn't that given greater consideration?
I think it was given consideration. I think there are multiple issues there. The first is that attachment itself is not one of the enumerated factors. Second, while courts do generally give great weight to guardian ad litems, they don't have to agree with the guardian ad litems. And the county doesn't have to agree with guardian ad litems. The question is whether the best interest analysis was done. Two reasonable people can do a best interest analysis and come to different conclusions. Regarding the extended timelines, I think there were parts on all parties. The county initially attempted to place the relatives back in December of 2017, but the court granted the part of the appellant's motion stopping that during the pendency of the motion for adoption placement. And that motion extended out for a significant period of time, which is part of the delay.
Well, but wasn't that delay because the county made one adopt relative placement that then disrupted? I mean, again, right. It seems like the delay in this case is occasioned by the county and completely.
So I think the delay initially in December, the county attempted to place LM. The court stopped that placement. The issues with LM didn't come up until April and May of 2018 that caused the county to say, okay, maybe we can no longer place it here, and the sibling had also moved. So that did extend it. Certainly, At that time, the county was not going to certainly place a DS, but they wanted to look into it. And after looking into it and reviewing the best interest factors and what was known about both parties, the county determined that DS was the more appropriate placement. And yes, significantly relying on cultural background, but also the fact that these biological relatives were familiar with the familial history as well and the health history.
But can anybody get that nowadays?
Assuming cooperation is possible, but it's easier and more likely for biological family to understand that information, especially since they were raising a sibling who was born under very similar circumstances and had a lot of the same prenatal and birth experiences as SL had.
The adoptive parents have been working, have been raising this child, right, from what, day two?
Yes.
So why wouldn't they be in the best position to know what's in the best interest of that child, including from medical care, seeing that child day in and day out?
In certain aspects, they probably are, but in the issue of the child's history and the familial history, the biological family will always remain in the best position because they are that family. And they are the ones with that history.
So if they're always in the best position, would a family always trump then adoptive parents?
No. Just because a family is in the best position to know familial history and any predispositions and needs from that history doesn't mean they're appropriate caretakers. There are certainly cases where we have relatives who would desire to raise a child, but they're just not appropriate caretakers for one reason or another. This isn't one of those cases. This is a case where both appellants and the current foster parents are appropriate caretakers for the children. And so it really came down to those historical and cultural issues.
Which the district court, at the end of the day, found more important than the potential damage occasioned by transitioning a child from people he's been with since he was born at the age of 16 months.
That's correct. And I think, you know, I don't think the district court needed to reach its own analysis because it didn't find that the county was unreasonable. But I think there are several factors regarding the attachment issue that caused the court to come to that conclusion. One is that attachment's not a settled science. The expert admitted that she had done the training several weeks before her testimony that caused her to change some of her opinions. So it's not clear where attachment is settled at and what.
Although stability is built into all of the child protection statutes, just the timing guidelines are based on stability and the fact that it's important for a child to be stable and be able to attach.
Yes,
at a young age.
I mean, at that point, we're talking about an 18-month-old, and so we're looking at stability over 18 months versus stability over 18 years, and who can provide the best permanency and stability for that child over his entire childhood, not just the 18 months he's already lived. But aside from attachment not being settled science, there was the issue on cross. The expert also admitted that the actual harm to the child in this case was unknown. Nobody could tell what the harm would be to the child. And the court also had testimony from the case manager that she believed that there were facts present in this case that mitigated potential harm, and testimony from DHS itself, the supervisor of DHS, that attachment can't outweigh any of the other factors, and attachment isn't the sole consideration in these cases. So I think all that together causes the court to say, all right, we need to look at these factors. Everybody recognizes attachment exists, but there was no concrete evidence that there would be harm from that attachment disruption, or what that harm would be, whether it be permanent or temporary, and whether, you know, whether it would be harmful to the child to remove him from his current home. And in fact, the expert did say at one point in her testimony that building that attachment with the foster parents did make it more likely for him to build future attachments, that had he not had that attachment, a move, attachment disruption harm could have been more likely and more severe.
Right, but we talked about the fact that there's nothing to show that the child would actually be harmed or to what extent the child would be harmed. But we're not talking about having to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that's going to happen. All appellants had to show what the likelihood of it.
Yeah, they had to show that it was more likely than not that
right.
The county was unreasonable. And given what the information regarding attachment, regarding the factors that the county believed did favor the biological relatives and the county's efforts, albeit late, to engage those relatives. The court found that it wasn't unreasonable. I don't think the issue is whether, you know, if attachment existed. The issue here is that the appellants want the court to basically say, if attachment exists, it's an abuse of discretion to place outside of the home that attachment is. There's no current law saying that.
That's not how I read it. I think the appellants were looking at the totality of circumstances too, were saying that the county and the district court shouldn't look at all the evidence and weighed it inappropriately, including not giving proper weight to the guardian ad litem and the unrebutted testimony of the expert in addition to the attachment issue. I don't think it was attachment issue alone.
But the court, and they did look at that testimony and give it due weight. There are...
Did the district court even consider, is there anything in the district court order indicating that it considered the guardian ad litem's testimony?
Not substantively. Much of her testimony was the same as the expert's. I think the court deferred to the expert where that testimony agreed. I think the guardian ad litem was mainly relying on the expert in coming to her conclusions. But the expert's testimony, I think, is mitigated by the fact that there was evidence that she had changed her position between initially consulting with the guardian ad litem and being hired by appellants, and that attachment was a theory where things are constantly changing. She had to change her opinions. And the fact that she frankly engaged in speculation regarding what the child would like or how the child feels during her testimony instead of just engaging in clinical opinions regarding attachment.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Ozfan, you have the last word.
On the issue of harm and attachment, it has been well briefed, but I would point the court to page 24 of appellant's initial brief, where we state Ms. McMahon's quote from the transcript on what the research says about harm. She did specifically speak to research. Could she say exactly what harm it will be? No. No, she could not. But she was unequivocal in saying that short of death, this is the worst thing you could do to a child. 18 months is the fundamental period in which a child learns to attach.
But the court made a specific finding, and I'm reading it. The court finds the child will suffer some pain due to his loss of the adoptive parents. However, the court does not find this threat so severe as to warrant placing its importance ahead of all of the other factors the court has addressed. And by that, I'm reading from the best interest findings in the court's order. How is that? I mean, is that wrong? Are you asking us to second guess and make our own findings or weigh the factors at de novo?
I am not, Your Honor, but an abuse of discretion under matter of the welfare of the child of RK includes when the court resolves the matter in a manner which is against logic and the facts on the record. And I would say that the court's decision was absolutely against the facts on the record. With respect,
but the district court considered that factor and considered a lot of factors, and really including the both of the key factors on both sides. And I think the district court acknowledged what a difficult case it was. And you've got two unusual situations where you've got two sets of families that are extremely qualified to take care of this child, and having to weigh that. On review, and as the opposing counsel noted, just because we disagree with the decision by the district court, that doesn't necessarily mean it's an abuse of discretion.
Understood, Your Honor. But I do think when you look at the record evidence that has been presented to the court, the transcript evidence, the fact that the guardian ad litem, both guardian ad litems, two separate guardian ad litems. The second one who said she did her own individual assessment of the case and came to the same conclusion. The only attachment expert in the case, the social worker for New Horizons who has worked with this family throughout the case, all came to the exact same conclusion and testified to the same basic facts to the court. The only person who was involved with the child and the foster parents who came to a different conclusion was the county social worker. And I do not think that the court's decision reflects that weight of evidence and facts. And I do think that under the law, that is an abuse of discretion.
Well, but we give great deference to the district court in weighing those facts. You can have 20 people testify one way and one person another way. And if the district court says, I'm giving careful consideration to all the testimony, just like credibility, we generally don't second guess that.
That's correct, but we do have this process for a reason, and abuse of discretion does apply. And I think that the court here, with all due respect to the district court, is very used to deferring to the county, sees the county all the time, CHIPS cases come from the county, and courts are very deferential to county positions. And this court is not accustomed to a contested adoption hearing. And I do think that there is some potential judicial obscurity that can be involved in that. And I think the court, as you read through the findings, the judge in multiple places supplants his own speculations as to what he thinks might happen in place of what was actual testimony from people in the case. For example, that he's concerned that the child might look for his biological family and might be upset that his biological family fought for him and he wasn't placed with him. That is not a weighing of the credibility of witnesses. And if that is the court's position, that would be very detrimental to the entire adoption system and to the recruitment of potential foster adopt and adoptive families. So I think it's very concerning that there's not one reference to the guardian ad litem's position or the guardian ad litem's determination in this best interest factors, when that is the guardian ad litem's essential role to speak to the child. I thank you for your time and again request that reversal of the district court's decision. Thank you.
Well, thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory period. Apologize again for our mid-argument delay, but the good news is there wasn't a fire, and so we were all safe. Well, anyway, it's been a pleasure to be here in Brown County today. That concludes our oral argument calendar, and we are in recess. Thank you.